Hi, I'm Rob Grease and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we present the story of Normie Rowe.
I recorded a song the other day, just a vocal for a young Aaron Shembri, who was a young up-and-coming songwriter, and he's got a whole lot of established singers singing the vocals on his demo album. I was thinking about how many songs I might have recorded over these years, and I know that available today there is something like 200. So I must have recorded well in excess of 300 or 400 songs, which is sitting in vaults in places, on top of the songs that I would have done on television. And, you know, that I've got a CD of almost all of the songs I did on the Don Lane show. And I listened to those, and I think, that was better than I thought I was.
Yeah. Talking of which, we were talking a little earlier about the fact that often it's how you present the music rather than the history of the music. Where I'm coming up from is you were talking about, you know, the Beethovens and the Bachs. If they'd only taught us in the right way, we might have listened. Your first big hit ain't necessarily so.
That was frightening.
That was hardly rock and roll, was it?
No,
It was massive. How did that come about? Why did that get chosen? And how did...
There was an Australian singer by the name of Ian Crawford. He went to the UK and had a band. I guess it was his genius. And he recorded a version of It Ain't Necessarily So, which had... our song was very loosely based from.
Right.
Okay, so we're talking... I use the word genius with this... with this man's name, Pat Alton, because Pat was a genius. And he got with the Playboys, who were listening to what they had recorded in the past. Today you listen to what they'd done, their album, and their instrumental support they gave me is, and they were a damn good band, one of the best bands in Australia, and as good, every bit as good as any of the English bands, most of the English, they just didn't write their own songs. And in those days, bands played instrumentals, singers sang the songs. You know, with Pat and his wonderful ability to arrange music in particular ways, and the band to be able to pick up what he meant and to be able to play it and come up with the guitar solos that Billy played and the beautiful bass sounds that Neil and the other bass players that we had.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible ain't necessarily so. Moses was found in a stream. Moses was found in a stream. Saved from the water by old Pharaoh's daughter. Moses was found in a stream. Jonah, he lived in a whale. Jonah, he lived in a whale. He made his home in that fish's abdomen. Jonah, he lived in a whale. It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so. The things that your preacher liable to teach ya ain't necessarily so.
Hey,
We had nine bass players. The Playboys had nine bass players.
Good Lord.
I said to Trotter, the drummer, and we only ever had one drummer, I said, Trotter, what instrument do you like tying into when in the band? He said, oh, the bass player. And I said, how many bass players did we have? And he said, there was Ronnie Brain, and there was Carroll, and there was MacArthur, and then there was... And I said, don't bother counting, I have it. It's nine.
Good Lord.
What does that say about you? You know, Trotter at 75 is still playing with
us. Yes, I know that. Yes.
And really plays well. Yes. I just...
He's a delightful
If he
man.
Ever hangs up his cymbals, it'll be a sad day for me.
That period from the early 60s right through to 1968, and I think you'll know why I'm stopping there in a second, you had just one hit after another.
Mm.
Did you ever get overwhelmed by it?
I think I was constantly overwhelmed, and the nature of my being overwhelmed became my normality. That was normal. It was just a normal thing.
Mm.
And fortunately for me, during that period of time, I went to England and things slowed down and I had a lot more time to think. I was very, very homesick when I was living in England, and I recorded some great stuff and had wonderful different places to go while I was there. I also, I know that if you look at how I presented myself before I went to England and how I presented myself when I came back, there was a big growth period that I didn't notice happening. All my clothes were Savile Row tailored, and you know, I had Vidal Sassoon doing my hair and all this sort of stuff. And when I came back to Australia, there was this really polished nature, which I don't think could have sustained in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, it really needed to have been an international thing. And without it, it would never have been an international thing. And so in many ways, I came back and I did a national tour, and then I was called up, and when I was called up...
For people listening who are younger generation, we're talking about the Vietnam War call-up here, aren't we?
Yeah, the national draft. Conscription or draft, as they call it in America, where they took a percentage of the young people turning 20 at four times a year, over a three-month period each year, and they would... train them as Australian soldiers, put them in various corps echelons. I was in the armoured corps. There were signals. There was transport. There were a whole lot of other corps, infantry, of course, the most important one.
Can I ask? So I don't want to. I am going to interrupt you because there's something I've been biting to ask you about this period in your life. Did you ever see, or did you ever think there was a parallel between what happened to you and Elvis?
Oh, it was clear. It was clear, and it was always been brought up by various people from journalists and radio television personalities and, you know, even friends and, you know, you see what's happening.
They
saw
it, but did you?
No, I didn't. I really didn't have time in my thought processes to deal with something like that, because I knew what was imminent and what was going to be taking place was going to be a very, very personally a very big thing in my life, as it was for all the 60,000 young Australians who were forced, press ganged into into the Australian military. I don't think that will ever happen again. And I don't think we should ever have national service again with that sort of bent. National service, I don't think, is probably a bad thing. But I don't think it needs to be of a military service. I think we all owe something for being, for getting the jackpot and being born in Australia. But anyway, all those sort of things aside, by the time I went into the army, it was almost like...
It was a relief.
Yeah.
That it had happened.
All that overwhelmness, if there's such a word, was... I was distracted from it by the training.
Yeah.
But it was... It wasn't part. I mean, there were elements of things that were popping up, and some of the really negative sides of being, of having any sort of notoriety came up. And especially, I wasn't like Carl Dietrich, who was a giant. You know, I was 5'6" you know. I had to be a bit smarter than most. I learned really quickly how to play within the rules.
That's survival technique.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of rules in the military, obviously, but there were a lot of people who were living outside the rules for their own ego benefit, you know. And I had this guy who was in those days, the PT instructors came from the artillery, and this bombardier was always making it tougher on me than everybody else. And I noticed it, and I said, it's okay. For instance, he would put Greg Roberts, who was the biggest guy in the platoon, and I saw him just on Saturday for the first time in 100 years, and he's still a big guy. And he'd pair me up with him for the fireman's carry, and you had to carry him all the way 100 metres, and then he would carry me back. Well, I don't think it did him any favours, but it did me favours, because I looked at it and said, who knows, one day I might have to actually carry one of my mates.
Oh, okay,
and
good point.
It's best for me to know that I can do it.
Good point.
And then he did it one day, and then he tripped me over because I was coping. I was coping with the shit he was giving me.
Yep.
And he tripped me over. And I copped it, sucked it up, and then I went to see the... platoon sergeant, and I said, "Sarge, I want to see the padre." And the minute you say, "I want to see the padre," you know that there is something wrong.
There's an issue.
Yeah. Yep. And he said, "Is there an issue?" And I said, "Yeah, but it's for the padre. It's personal." And he said, "Look, I have to let you go and see the platoon leader." So I went to see Lieutenant Harrington.
So you've got to see the officer before you get to see the padre.
Yeah, and what he tries to do is, you know, otherwise the padre is going to see 1,700 people a day.
Oh, okay. Oh, goodness. So, yeah,
and if you can nip it in the bud, great.
Sure,
so
of course.
He said, "What's the issue?" And I said, "Well, I'd rather say it to the padre." And he said, "Well, is there something that I can help you fix?" And I said, "Well, perhaps." And I told him about what happened. And he said, "Well, what do you want done with it?" And I said, "Well, I don't mind doing what I'm supposed to do. I'll front up every day. I'll do everything I'm supposed to do. But I won't be bastardized."
Mm.
Right? And he said, "Yeah, well, neither you should be. You don't have to be." And I said, "Well, in that case, I don't want to see this bombardier ever again. I don't want to see him anywhere. But before he goes, he disappears, I want him to stand out and apologise to me in front of the platoon. And then I want him gone, and I don't want to see any of this treatment again." And I said, "Sir, I'm going to tell you this now. The next time I won't be coming to you. I will go and I'll demand to see the padre. And at the same time, I'll write a letter to my parents and ask them to make that letter an open letter to the newspapers."
Did that get a response?
And next day the guy apologised and we didn't see him again.
Part of me's amazed and part of me's pleased. I'm pleased because there was a form of justice. I'm amazed that the army would respond so well. The image you get, not having been called up, I'm fortunate or not fortunate, missed out. I'd always had this image that was very rigid. And
you National Service wasn't popular.
No, it was not popular.
It was not a popular thing. And Harold Holt was copping really bad flak. Of course, it was started by Menzies, but Menzies retired. And Holt was copping really bad flak. In fact, it was Holt's fault that I was in the army in the first place, because his military attaché advisor was a captain who said to him, "You know what you really need, sir?
Yeah.
You need an Elvis Presley."
Yeah,
and he said,
okay.
"How so?" And he said, "Well, Elvis Presley was called up. You need to go." And he said, "Who have we got as an Elvis Presley in Australia?" He said, "Normie Rhodes." And he said that if he was going to be called up, he would go. Because I thought it was, if everybody else was called up and I was called up, that would be fair. If I didn't get called up, then, that's do exactly what everybody else was doing. So he said he'd go. So why don't you just make sure he goes? So there was, what people don't realise, there was the initial ballot, which was done with the Tats marbles, and I had registered late because I didn't even realise that this was a problem. I registered late because I was living in England, and I registered the day I got back.
Right.
And then, the day after I got back. So I didn't get called up in that next ballot, so they had a supplementary ballot.
I'm funny about that, isn't it?
And yeah. I didn't get called up in that.
Oh, you didn't get called
and
up.
And then they had another supplementary ballot until I did, but I was the only one on my birthday to have been called up. So, you know.
You wouldn't have been human if you didn't feel aggrieved.
With any politician or bureaucrat.
No, yeah, with every politician or
even
bureaucrat.
Even the way they told me. I was told by the press gallery.
Oh, you're kidding.
I was doing a tour in Western Australia.
Your heart must have sunk.
And they said, how does it feel now you've been called up? I said, I haven't. They said, "Oh yes, you have." So they knew before my parents had got the letter at home. So you know, I just despite, and every single dealing I've ever had, except for one, from a lady from it's a story in my book actually, Normie Rose story. There was this one lady I call my guardian angel, and I was having a severe time with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression and all sorts of really bad times were taking place for me. And she was working for CES, which is now Centrelink.
Mm.
And anyway, I'd rather you read it in the story. Mm. It takes up a bit of time. So all I could say about the military was that I went into it nose down and backside up. We worked hard. There was only two of us out of the platoon, 60 strong, that went to armour. I'm still best friends with that other fella, Tim Little. He's still one of my best friends in the world. It's funny, probably my really closest friends are from the military and not from show business.
Yeah. No, that doesn't surprise me.
He's not the same who went away last year. Gone is the boy, in place a man, not far away it's he. His eyes told stories all about the fear and sweat and pain, and all the lives of his young mates that politics flushed down the drain. The enemy at home worse than the foe he fought back there. Of honor, duty, loss and grief, they didn't seem to care. So he went missing in action from the time he got back home.
And sadly, we don't have time to investigate because there's probably program after program here. You couldn't go through such an intense period of your life and not be melded with the people with you.
I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think so. I always likened it to being in a sporting team. You finish your year, good or bad, and you go away on a holiday somewhere. Go, you know, that footy team holiday thing. And you always remember that.
Oh, yes.
Don't you? You always remember you went away with the cricket team or the footy team or the netball team or the, you know. And then heighten that with the element of life-threatening experiences.
Yeah.
Daily.
Yeah.
And then you have perhaps just a minor understanding of the way we feel about each other.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.